Well, in our study tonight, we're going to be studying from Matthew chapter 19, primarily. We're also going to be studying some from Mark's account, Mark chapter 10, verses 1 through 12. And I want to, before we read that text, I want to look at some introductory remarks on the board with you, and this will be on our website, so if you don't get this down, go to our website and look at these next three charts. Because they, I think, give us a chronology. Keep in mind, those of you that have been studying with us in the life of Christ for a lengthy period of time know that the series of lessons have been designed around the chronology of the life of Christ. We're trying to get the events not only in mind, but to get them in order. Learn the lessons, but try to get them in chronological order. Kyle Pope writes in a commentary, to help us a little bit with this, because our study tonight is, like I said, primarily from Matthew 19. But we want to see where that fits in the accounts, in the chronology that's given by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And if we can do that, and take just a moment of time, I don't want to use a lot of time on this, but I do want us to see where we are studying in the chronology of the life of Christ. Now, when we were looking at some text in the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Luke, we've recently noted that we're about a week and a few days prior to Jesus' execution. So that's where we are on the timeline, where these events are taking place. Keeping that in mind, we know that Matthew does not give us all of the events in that timeline. Luke does not give us all of the events in that timeline. John was never designed to be a chronology of the life of Christ. Mark's events here fit on a place in the timeline about a week and a half before Jesus was arrested and crucified. So what we want to note is where this is in relation to his final trip to Jerusalem. Now, those of you that have studied with us in the Gospel of John know that it's primarily from the Gospel of John that we can account for the length of Jesus' earthly ministry. Now, the reason that we look to John to do that, and we could look at the other accounts, Kyle does some of this in his comments, but I want to focus our attention tonight on John. And I would encourage you to go to the website and read these charts. Matthew marks the end of Jesus' discourse on sin and forgiveness. That's in chapter 18. With the seventh transitional phrase, that's what he calls this phrase, when Jesus had finished such and such, then something else happened. So we've got some transitional phrases that Kyle points out in his comments. But with these phrases, Matthew signals the beginnings and endings of major narratives and discourses throughout the gospel. Jesus travels toward Jerusalem, where the remaining events described in the gospel prior to the resurrection take place. Before this, Jesus will teach and heal beyond the Jordan. Now, that's the first part that you see of the 19th chapter. The very first verse. The next geographical reference in the gospel, that is in the Gospel of Matthew, placed Jesus with the 12 going up to Jerusalem. Now, that's in the 20th chapter. Now, why is he going up to Jerusalem in the 20th chapter? Well, what was the purpose of his going up to Jerusalem that's recorded in the Gospel of John that tell us how long Jesus preached? Well, he's going up to Jerusalem to observe the Passover. That's right.
John what?
Well, I'm getting ready to tell you that. I haven't told you yet. But that would be... I'm sorry? Well, I'm about to tell you. Just hang on a second. John chapter 2, verse 13. John chapter 5, verse 1. And it would be a good idea to write these down if you are taking notes. And John chapter 6, verse 4. And then John chapter 13, verse 1. And you say, well, that's four mentions of the Passover. That's right. And the years in between those mentions of the Passover is the time that Jesus preached. So Jesus preached for about 6 months, went to Jerusalem to observe the Passover. Preached for another year, went to Jerusalem to observe the Passover. And so you can line those up, and when you get to the last one in John chapter 13, that's his last entrance into the city of Jerusalem where he was crucified. Yes. Yes, sir. John chapter 2, verse 13. John chapter 5, verse 1. John chapter 6, verse 4. And John chapter 13, verse 1. So that, to me, is very helpful. John's account is the single account that helps us to be able to do that. Now, we find other mentions in these other accounts, but John's is the most helpful because it puts the space. And Jesus preached in between these times, and then you add that 6 months on the front end of it that he began preaching before that first mention. And now we've got Jesus preaching for 3.5 years. That's how we know the length of his earthly ministry. So he was going up to Jerusalem. Matthew's account now gives us that in chapter 20. Now you know what happened in chapter 21, right? In chapter 21, he was arrested. And then chapter 22, we see all the events beginning, the dialogue between Jesus and the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And then to 22, we've got this back and forth. And 23, we've got Jesus pronouncing, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites," over and over in Matthew 24. Then you've got his prophecy about the fall of Jerusalem, Matthew 25, the need to be prepared, the great judgment scene. Matthew 26, what happens? He's arrested. Matthew 27, he's crucified. Matthew 28, he's raised from the dead. Now, that's Matthew's account. So this helps us, I think. And I want to look at this second chart with you, also from Kyle. He says that John acknowledged in his own gospel that there are many other things that Jesus did among his disciples which are not written in this book. Now, you've memorized that, John 20, 30, and 31. Okay? But these things are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. We want to remember those passages. But we want to make this point that John does not record all of the things that Jesus did. So if we're looking at a chronology that gives everything of Jesus' life, we don't have one. There's just not one. Because none of the gospel accounts record all of them. They just don't. That's not their purpose, to tell us everything that Jesus did, but to tell us what he did, not necessarily everything. Now, noting that, it is clear that the same could be said for all of the Gospels. Matthew has been led by the Holy Spirit to organize his record of Jesus' life in simplified geographical terms. Jesus moves from the northern ministry toward Jerusalem and his ultimate death. It is clear, however, that Jesus made 3 trips to Jerusalem during his public ministry. John records 2 additional trips to Jerusalem before this last entry into the city. So you've got John 13 in addition to these that we mentioned. Now here is a broader citation of passages that we want to note. This should not be understood as an omission. Each gospel writer has a different emphasis, and that's right. When you look at Matthew's account, who was it written to? Jews, yes. That's why Matthew, you'll note, a lot of references to Old Testament quotations, because these Jews that would receive that letter would know the things that he's writing about. The Gospel of Mark, who were the recipients of it? Gentiles. And so you don't see the quotations from Old Testament scripture like you do in Matthew, and you would not expect to, because you've got a different audience. And so you've got a different approach. Now John's, Luke, we might want to get Luke while we're talking. He's writing things, and I call your attention to this as we did in the lesson recently from Luke chapter 1 about verse 3. He's writing these things to Theophilus. Now there's a lot of debate about who that was, whether it was a character or whether it was a church or a group of Christians. Be that as it may, that's not our point tonight. But he's writing these things to give a chronology. You see that? He says, "I'm writing these things, O Theophilus, in order." These are in order. So it helps us then to put them in a correct order. That's the purpose of Luke writing, to give a narrative. And then John, of course, is writing to provide evidence. It's not intended to be a narrative. "These things I'm writing to you so that you can believe that Jesus is the Christ." John does not mention but 7 miracles out of all the many miracles that he performed. Out of all the many miracles that Jesus performed, just to be clear. Okay? So what we want to note then is that the gospel writers have different emphasis in their book. But he said we should note, however, a few significant events in Jesus' life not recorded in Matthew that happened during this time. These are included, or include the Samaritan village rejecting Jesus' teaching, Luke chapter 9, and we've talked about that. The sending out of the 70, we've talked about that in this class. Dinner with Mary and Martha in Luke 10, healing of the woman that had the spirit of infirmity in the synagogue. A dinner with a Pharisee. The 3 parables concerning lost things in Luke 15. The parables of the unjust steward
the account of the rich man and Lazarus, Jesus teaching on faith and duty. These are all things that we've talked about. Matthew also was not led to record the raising of Lazarus. We read about that in John 11. We've recently talked about that. This event greatly fueled the desire of the Jewish leaders to kill Jesus, forcing him to stay for time in a city named Ephraim, thought to have been east of Bethel. Now, his comments about these things are right on target, but it helps us to see that each gospel account had a different purpose. Wasn't the same purpose in all of them, and therefore you're not reading just one chronological account of the life of Jesus. And noting that, I think, is very helpful. Now, that brings us to Matthew, the 19th chapter. You see now where it is on the timeline. We're just a little bit over a week out from the time that Jesus was crucified. And if you'll turn back now to Matthew, the 19th chapter, just the mention of the book and chapter raises a flag, doesn't it? You know what Matthew 19, at least the first part, is about. Because we've studied this so much and it's been such a divisive issue among brethren, marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And I don't know how to study this without dealing with some of those topics, because that's what the paragraph is about. So look at your Bible, Matthew chapter 19. Now we've set the stage, verses 1 and 2. It came to pass when Jesus had finished these words, he departed from Galilee and came unto the borders of Judea beyond the Jordan. And great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. So we've got Jesus on his way into the city of Jerusalem for the very last time. Okay? He's come from Galilee up north on his way into the city of Jerusalem for the last time, approaching the city. Now in verse 3, it says, "And there came unto him Pharisees trying him, saying, Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause?" Now I'm going to read through the text that naturally joins together, and then we're going to go back through it and just try to dissect it. But the next verse says, "He answered and said, Have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh, so that they are no more two, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. They say unto him, Why then did Moses command to give a bill of divorcement to put her away? And he saith unto them, Moses, for your hardness of heart, suffered you to put away your wives. But from the beginning it hath not been so. And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And he that marrieth her, when she is put away, committeth adultery." Now, I would dare say that most of you have read this many times. Would that be a pretty fair assumption? You've read this many times, and rightfully so, because if you want to know what God's Word says about marriage, divorce, and even remarriage, you need to be familiar with this passage. And I would suggest very strongly that you be well familiar with it. Those of you who are not married, you be well familiar with it before you ever even start to date somebody. I've got a reason for that, because Jesus talks about adultery. And we're going to talk about the demands of repentance when we've committed adultery. What do we do about it? And what constitutes adultery? How do we fix this before the Lord? I was teaching a Bible class one time, just to give you a heads up of the direction that I'm going. I had a young lady in the class, and we were making the point that the Apostle Paul said that some can get themselves into a circumstance where the only satisfactory solution, only scriptural solution is, and you can read this, 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11, "Do not divorce, but if you do, remain unmarried, or else be reconciled." And I was making the point that someone might find themselves in a position where the only solution they have is to remain unmarried. And if I understand that, as simple as it is, that means you can't get married. You must remain unmarried. Now that sounds awful. Just sounds awful hard. And we're going to talk about that in this segment of our study. But the young lady that was in the class that I didn't think was paying attention, when I said that, her head snapped up and said, "Well, that means we better be careful who we marry." I said, "Yeah, you got that right." She was listening. "You got that exactly right. We best be careful who we're married." So, what is God's law for governing marriage. Simple rule. God's rule is one man, one woman, for life. One exception. Now you would think, having said that, that'd be the end of the discussion, wouldn't you? But you know, folks, we can say that, and there's still folks that want to argue with what's said in this. One man, one woman, for life, one exception. Now, first of all, I want us to look and note that the question that is asked by these Pharisees is asked for a reason. Their question is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any cause? Just any cause. For every cause. Now, does that need explaining? We need to see what their question is. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any cause? Now, I think it's important for us to wrap our minds around their question for this reason, because often our question is not about divorce. The question we want to ask is about remarriage after divorce. That was not their question. Jesus deals with it, so we'll have to deal with it. It's a part of his answer. But that was not a part of their question. Their question was causes for divorce. Can a man divorce his wife for just any cause? Now, if we don't see that to be their question, then we need to pause and establish that that's what they're asking. They want to know what is God's law, not Roman law, not civil law, but what is God's law about divorce? Now, we all on the same page? That's their question. Okay, we've got to see that. Now let's notice how Jesus begins to answer it. Jesus said, "Have ye not read?" Now I like that. Because Jesus doesn't just say, "Well, my opinion is this. This is what I think." He says, "Have you not read?" And I would suggest to you that when you're asked a Bible question, you give a Bible answer. Their question is a legitimate question. Their motive is wrong. But their question is a legitimate question. And to answer a legitimate question, the appropriate answer is, let's turn to this passage and read it. Now that's what Jesus said. Have you not read? Well, read what? That he who made them from the beginning made them male and female and said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now let's just pause right there. Lots of information in that. Their question is about divorce. Jesus begins to answer their question, citing what God said from the beginning about marriage. Now he doesn't go back to the law of Moses. Some want to contend, well, what Jesus says in this passage is only applicable to those who were Jews because they were under the law of Moses. The audience that Jesus is addressing is the Pharisees, you'll note in verse 3. Okay, the Pharisees are the ones that are asking the question. And grant, yes, the audience very well may be a Jewish audience. But Jesus does not take them back to what Moses said in the law. He takes them back to what God said in the beginning. Now, I've had somebody try to respond to that and say, well, who did Moses write that to? Who wrote Genesis? Well, Moses did. Who did you write it for? They said, well, Moses wrote that for the benefit of the Jews. I deny it with everything that's in me. Moses wrote it. He wrote it by inspiration. And he wrote it before there was any such thing as a Jew. Referencing what God did in the beginning. Do we see that? In the beginning, here's what God did. Why, you just well talk about creation, because that's it. God created the marriage relationship. What did he say about marriage? In the beginning, God said, for a man to leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. That's what God said in the beginning about marriage. Now, I like to emphasize when I'm studying with folks that are about to get married or thinking about getting married or thinking about dating or thinking about boys or thinking about girls, you need to understand what God said about the marriage relationship from the beginning. And what you need to note is not only the permanency of that relationship, leave father and mother and cleave. You're not ready to do that. You're not ready to even be thinking about getting married.
leave and cleave. And look further in this text. Jesus said, have you not read, that God made them male and female? Hammer drops on that point. You see, as we read in the beginning, God created Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. And that's not just a cute expression, that's right. God did not make a man for a man. God made a woman for the man. Because there was nothing to complement man out of all the creatures of the earth. And what did God see as a solution to that? He made a woman. He didn't make another man. You see, if he'd made another man, you wouldn't be here. He made a woman. Because there was no creature on the top side of God's green earth, and that included Adam. You see, you couldn't just rubber stamp another Adam and say, all right, now man's got a companion. No, no. He made someone to complement Adam. He made a woman. And now we've got the beginning of the marriage relationship. Now, man, you leave father and mother and you cleave to your wife. Now, what does that suggest to us about God's arrangement of marriage from the beginning? And what does that tell us about the practices of homosexuality and lesbianism and bestiality and all the various things that we could talk about? In fact, we're going to talk about some of them on this very chart. What I want us to note are the implications of Genesis chapter 2. It requires some things. It requires a man and it requires a woman. Do we see that? Can't have two men, can't have two women. In order for this marriage relationship to exist, it requires a man who is to be joined to his wife. That's as simple as I know how to say it, because that's how the Lord said it. Now, what does that exclude? If it includes a man and his wife, then it excludes any deviation from that. Period. Any deviation from that. A man, not somebody else's wife. See, that don't work. A man and his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. What does that mean? That means in the marriage relationship, the desires, the passions that God placed within you are to be fulfilled. Not outside of that relationship. That means that you don't live like animals do. If you want to satisfy the physical desires, then it's in the marriage relationship, because that's where God put it. You don't live like animals. So committing fornication is not a viable alternative. That wasn't what God designed. Adultery. A man with somebody else's wife. Or a woman with somebody else's husband. Somebody said, well, we need to define adultery. We're going to put a dictionary definition on it in a little bit, but I want to look at this. Because I think it's so simple. When you think of adultery, you think of the general category of fornication, and you say what we've got in adultery is the same act, but it involves one or the other or both of somebody that's married. That's just fornication with somebody you don't have a right to have. That's adultery. There's somebody else's wife, somebody else's husband. Polygamy, a man having multiple wives. You know, contrary things have happened in times gone by, and we'll see that. Concubinage. Somebody said, well, what is that? We had a chart back some time ago in a lesson where we were talking about immorality that existed during first century times. And I wanted to note in that chart that concubines were thought of in the Roman world as women for pleasure to meet or satisfy a man's day-to-day needs, quote, unquote. But a wife was selected to bear children and to take care of the children. Okay? I want to suggest to you that was never God's plan. God didn't arrange that. Now you know where that came from. That came from the desires of man. Homosexuality, bestiality. All of these are forms of fornication. Every one of them. Now what we want to do is to see, and we'll, like I say, I think I have a chart on this, a dictionary definition. But it implies that immorality desecrates this union. When Jesus said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife, anything outside of that is a violation of the sanctity, and I'm going to use that word, and I'm going to define that too,
When we think of sanctity, we think of something that is sanctified, something that is holy, something that is set apart. It's special. Marriage is that. It's set apart and special because God designed that. Okay? Any deviation from that desecrates that union. It's not holy anymore. It's not what God intended for it to be. And it becomes grounds for the one who is innocent to put away the one who's violated that relationship, the one who's guilty. And when we talk about a man, his wife, and one flesh, notice the pattern. You cleave to that relationship. Leave and cleave. That word cleave, we've defined that in times gone by, simply meaning to be glued to or to stick like glue. That's what you do. Bruce had an expression I thought that was perhaps even a little bit more definitive. I've done some woodworking in times gone by, and I'm sure most of you have at one point or the other, glued wood together and got it wrong. You ever let it set and try to take it apart and redo it? You can't do that. It just messes everything up. It's never the same. It's never the same. It damages both pieces. But Bruce used the illustration of welding. I like that because he said you get the metals so hot that they blend together. So now you've created a blended spot on the metal. Glue just sticks them together, yes, and it damages both when you take it apart. But welding blends the two metals together into one. Now what do you do when you try to tear that up? Well, you just tear the whole thing up. You cannot successfully do that. You tear it all up. Now, that's what we see that has been done to the marriage relationship. But if these things desecrate the relationship, then by logical conclusion, then the one that's put away for doing this, he doesn't have the privilege of marrying somebody else at will. He can't do that. Now, do we see that? And that's what Paul was pointing out in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 10 and 11. Remain unmarried. Here's somebody who can't do that. You can't get married. Any questions on that part? Yes?
So the argument that gets brought up a lot is that verse 6 specifically says, you know, whatever God has put together, let no man tear apart. But the question becomes, at what point is it a real marriage? Like if you got civil and you didn't do it for the church or something to that effect, then it's not legit, and then you do whatever or not. You know, so that gets asked a lot. So I just,
yes. Well, let me address that just briefly, and I'll come back to it in more detail as we get down to verse 6. But what we do want to note is that the church does not validate or invalidate a marriage relationship. What God has joined, let not man put asunder. God does the joining. And it's God that recognizes either a legitimate, lawful divorce under these circumstances, or he does not, which makes it an unlawful divorce. Now, I'm going to talk more on that, verse 6, because it says, let not man put asunder. Doesn't mean it can't be done, but it can't lawfully be done. Okay? You can't do that and please the Lord. Check me, Richard, if you would, please. I'm not certain which chart I have, the dictionary definition.
Slide 17.
Slide 17. Okay, I knew I had a slide on it, but I didn't know which slide it was. Slide 17. So I want to get over and look at that, and I'm not going to run it up here on the projector. Slide 17. Adultery must be defined by the use Jesus made of the term unlawful sexual intercourse involving someone under the constraint of God's marriage law. Now, I didn't know exactly how many slides I had in front of it, but I've got some that discusses the constraint of God's law. And I wanted those in front of that. But that's the dictionary definition. Unlawful sexual intercourse involving someone under the constraint of God's marriage law. Fornication is simply the broader element of that. Fornication is unlawful sexual intercourse, period.
Adultery is like a subset,
yes. Adultery is simply fornication with somebody that's under restraint of God's marriage law. They've married somebody. They can't do that. Okay? Fornication is illicit sexual intercourse, period. Whether it be male with male, female with female, bestiality, concubinage, male and female. It's just unlawful sexual intercourse. All of them are fornication. Adultery is fornication involving married folks. Bestiality is fornication involving people with animals. Homosexuality is male with male and female with female. It still is unlawful sexual intercourse. All of that's fornication. Polygamy, same thing, only multiple wives, or some want to turn that around, multiple husbands. Pardon me? I'm sorry?
When it says man, it includes women.
It does. It does. Yeah, what sex you are don't matter. It's unlawful. If it's unlawful, it's fornication. God provided this in the marriage relationship. Well, what I want to do with this chart is to note that there are consequences to sin. There are consequences to sin. In Matthew 19, 1 through 9, Jesus is explaining this basic rule. One man, one woman, for life, one exception. When we study in the book of Deuteronomy, we see an Old Testament principle that becomes simply a principle. And I'm going to say it that way because I don't know how else to say it. If you'll turn to Deuteronomy chapter 10, look with me in verse 13. It's repeated a number of times. Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 13. There the text says, well, I'm going to begin at verse 12. And now, Israel, what doth Jehovah thy God require of thee but to fear Jehovah thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve Jehovah thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and to keep the commandments of Jehovah and his statutes, which I command thee this day, for thy good. And somebody said, well, you mean what we're talking about concerning marriage and divorce is for my good? That's right. That's just exactly right. It's for my good. I never in my life talked to anybody that experienced a divorce, either one who was guilty of fornication or one who was innocent putting away the guilty, who described it as a cakewalk. It's not for your good. It's just not for your good. God's commandments are for your good. He doesn't want you to go through the miserable consequences involving divorce. Keep in mind that sin brings hardship. It's not designed to permit, with God's approval, privilege. Sin doesn't do that. You don't commit sin and receive a blessing from God for it. There's consequences to that. If you'll turn in your Bible to Proverbs chapter 13 and look with me at verse 15. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 15. There the writer says, good understanding giveth favor, but the way of the transgressor is hard. And you see, if I choose a path of sin, don't expect that to be rewarding to you. It's just not. Don't expect that to be free of stress and pleasant, everything's wonderful. It's not. The way of the transgressor is hard. Now, when we look at God's law, we see that's what sin does. Now, it implies, and I've got to make this point, that the bond is only in this life. Keep in mind what Jesus said in Matthew's account. For this cause shall a man leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. How long does marriage last? You know, there are those who say, well, you know, if I'm a Mormon and I go over to Salt Lake City and get married in the temple over there in Salt Lake City, then we can be married in eternity. Well, that's just not so. That's just not so. Jesus said the two shall become one flesh. Flesh don't exist on the other side, which tells us marriage don't exist on the other side. Folks say, well, you know, I love my husband, I love my wife, I want to be married forever. Good luck with that. God didn't design the marriage relationship to last forever. He just didn't. It's in this life. It's a fleshly relationship. And there were those who didn't understand that. And of all people to ask the question in Matthew chapter 22, you're well familiar with the illustration of the Sadducees, which the text tells us did not believe in the resurrection. But their question was, in an effort to trap the Lord, this man got married. And the law says that if he dies and he don't have any children, then his brother's to take his wife and bring up children to his brother's honor. Okay? So this man died. And wife remains, so his brother takes the wife. Still no children. He dies. Next brother takes the wife. He dies. All seven of them died. And then the wife died. Now in the resurrection, whose wife shall she be? For all seven had her. That's their question. They think they've got it. And Jesus said, you do err. You don't know the scriptures and you don't know the power of God. He said in the resurrection, they're neither married nor given in marriage. Now what does that tell us about living with somebody that I just love so dearly? I'm going to live with them forever. No, you're not. No, you're not. Because the marriage relationship is in this flesh. Do we not see that? Now that answers a lot of questions, by the way, that somebody would ask from Matthew 22. God's ideal in Genesis 2 verse 24 is reflected throughout the Old Testament history. We see that in the law. Do not commit adultery. Well, what does that tell us? Marriage is held in honor. It's to be something that's sanctified. And you can read that in Hebrews 13:4. And when you read over here in Malachi chapter 2 verse 14 through 16, very simply it tells us what their practice was. They were in a habit of just divorcing their wives, and Malachi said, what you're doing to your wives is treachery. That's the word the Bible uses. And what's God's attitude about it? You look at verse 16, it says, God hates divorce. Now we know what God thinks about it, don't we? Now you look at all the divorces across the country that have occurred, and look at all the fallout of people that are lives damaged because of it, and you see why God hates it. You see exactly why God hates it. But this is what they were doing, and this is what the Jews were doing when they asked this question of Jesus. They're asking him a question to entrap him. And Jesus points out from the beginning, not so. Not been so from the very beginning. Now, does that mean man hasn't tried it? These passages are helpful to me in studying this issue. Because when you look back in Genesis chapter 2, you see what God's design was in the beginning. And you just follow that thing on down. Again, these charts will be on our website if you find something you find intriguing and you want to study further. But you'll notice in Genesis chapter 4, the first case where a man had more than one. Well, was that according to God's pattern? No, that was a deviation from it. In Genesis chapter 12, you'll read there about a man offering his wife to another. You know who that man was? It's Abraham. Yes, that was Abraham. He offered his wife to somebody else. Well, was that according to God's pattern? No, sir. In Genesis chapter 16, we read about a man who had a child by his household maid. You know who that was? All right. Well, what are we learning? These are departures from God's plan. In Genesis chapter 25, we read about a man taking concubines. Well, you probably know who that is. In Genesis 26, again, you read about a man who offered his wife to another. You know his name? Isaac. Yes, sir. In Genesis chapter 30, we read about a man who took his household maid. You know who that man's name is? Uh-huh. Yeah. And then in Genesis chapter 6, backing up just a bit, we note that the world became so wicked that God destroyed it by the means of a flood during the days of Noah. Do you think some of these things were contributors to that? Same kind of things. Even the imagination of man's heart was only evil continually. And in Genesis chapter 11, we note that men tried to unite themselves against God in building the Tower of Babel. And God fixed that too, didn't he? And then we note that the Gentiles cast off God and so rejected God. God rejected them as well. And we see a part of that was man's attitude about marriage. And I'll call your attention to Romans chapter 1. Where man became subject to God's wrath because he thought himself so smart. He became a fool, and he began to worship his idols and serve them. And what did the idols let him do? Well, anything they wanted to. Well, what did they want to do? Verse 24, wherefore God gave them up in the lust of their heart unto uncleanness, that their bodies should be dishonored among themselves, for that they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this cause God gave them up unto vile passions, for their women changed the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another. Men with men, working unseemliness and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was due. Now what were they practicing? Homosexuality. That's what they were practicing. God gave them up to their vile passions. Was that a departure from God's way from the beginning? Yes. And why? Because man thought he knew more than God and he became a fool and created idols so he could worship the idols and do what he wanted to. That's where he went. So what we see is the practices that we're engaged in that were departures from God's plan from the very beginning. That's why when these asked the question in Matthew 19 about divorce, Jesus said, "Have you not read what God said about marriage in the beginning?" Now maybe I'm spending too much time, probably am on this point, but there's been so much confusion and divorce and homes destroyed because we don't understand this. Or maybe we understand it and we just don't want to practice it. I don't know. But the society in which we live probably is just simply ignorant of this and doing the very thing that Romans 1 did, thinking that we know more than God said about this, so we'll do what we want to. And that's what we have. And we have the consequence. Now, I tried to emphasize this question. Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? Note the motive of the question. Why did they ask him that? Were they interested in the answer? Well, they didn't care what the answer was. They're trying to entrap him. The text tells us they asked him that because they were tempting him. Now, what was temptation about this? Here's Jesus, the greatest teacher that ever walked the earth. All right, so Jesus, we've got two schools of thought among the Jews. Which one do you endorse? You see, there was one school of thought that followed the teaching of this man, Shammai, and he interpreted Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, to mean that man could not release his wife unless he found some indecency in her. In other words, had to be some just cause to release his wife or to send her away. Here was another school of thought that thought anything will do. Anything will do. Now, Jesus, where do you stand? Now, can you imagine what they must have thought, knowing the exposure of these two schools of thought and how widely apart they were? And now they're trying to cast Jesus on one side or the other. Where do you fit? And you know what he said? Have you not read? See, he didn't subscribe to either one of these men. He referred to what God said in the beginning. Now that's how we need to answer that question. Have you not read? You see, it's easy to get on one side or the other side and take some school or philosophy of thought, but it's just a whole lot easier to quote what the Scriptures say. Have you not read? Here's what God said about that in the very beginning. You see, once again, we've got Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. So again, we're emphasizing this same point. One man, one husband, cleaving to each other. Now, to get to verse 6. Having said, here's what God said in the beginning. Then Jesus' divine commentary, if you please, on that is what God has joined together. Let not man put asunder. Now we want to underscore in that. God has done the joining. Okay? He's the one that's validated this, not man. And then when he says, let not man put it asunder, that's worthy of some comment. We need to know what that says. Some say that because God has joined a man and his wife, then it's impossible for man to put that asunder. Well, that can't be true. That just can't be true because Jesus deals with the effort of man to do that in verse 9 and points out that a man does do that. He does do the very thing God said not to do. And when he does and marries another, he's committed adultery. And we're going to talk about how he compounds his sin when he does that, but no doubt he's committed sin because he's done the very thing God said not to do. Let not man put asunder. Doesn't mean it's impossible to put it asunder, but you can't do it lawfully. Now that's their question. Is it lawful for a man to do it? No, Jesus said no. Now I like simple. You ever take a multiple choice test in school? I passed a math test one time. I don't have any idea how I passed it because none of the answers that were a part of the choices was mine. I just wrote down the answer that was the closest to the one I got. And you'll be surprised to know that I scored higher on that test than anybody in our school. And it wasn't because I knew math. You know, with a multiple choice question, the answer's down there somewhere. Even if it's none of the above, the answer's on the page. You just have to check the right box, right? Now let's make this simple. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for every cause? Isn't that their question? All right, let's answer it. Yes or no? Which one is it? No. Isn't that simple? Now, somebody wants to ask that question. The answer is not hard. Jesus said, have you not read? And here's the answer to it. The answer is no. All right? So what we learn in this statement is that there are three involved in a lawful marriage. A man, a woman, and God. He does the joining. Now, can man put it asunder? Yes, but not lawfully. Can man put it asunder? He can lawfully if there is this one cause that we're going to talk about. Okay? One cause. Now, does that help to answer your question? Why? I think it avoids a lot of the complexities. Here's the question. Here's the answer. Okay. Well, I wish we had time to just go through all of these, but we'll pick this up next Wednesday night.